We are talking today with George Rishmawi, who is the Travel and Encounter Coordinator with the Holy Land Trust. George has been on the show before. George, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So start out and tell us what brings you back to the U.S.?
Well, several things. I have lots of friends in the U.S. and I really would love to connect with a lot of friends who really dedicated their lives and energy just for peace and justice. So this is one thing I try to connect with all friends and the people who really are supporting the Palestinian cause. And in addition to this, I do go in public speakings all over the U.S. and try to meet churches and groups and university students, wherever, just to inform them about the situation in Palestine and what does it mean to be a Palestinian living under occupation. This is mainly why I really come here once or twice a year.
What was it like coming over here to travel to the U.S.? Did you have to go through any hurdles to get here?
Actually, yeah. This has been the most difficult time for me trying to leave the country. What's going on right now around Bethlehem, that Israelis are building the wall around Bethlehem. The wall is not taking place like the north of the West Bank. North of the West Bank is being built by 8 meters high of concrete wall, and it's really very long along the being built in the West Bank, confiscating a lot of land. In Bethlehem, it's taking place as a beltway or a belt line around Bethlehem, an asphalt road, patrol road, then several layers of fences. We're talking about electric fences, electronic fences, and barbed wire fences. Now, this beltway is going to make Bethlehem the highest density population in the West Bank and one of the highest in the world. Now, for me, the range I can move in Bethlehem, I can drive my car, is less than 3 miles. That's the range what everybody in Bethlehem can move. About 60,000 people live there. Not just like this. Now, there is only one road that links between the southern and the northern areas of the West Bank, Hebron, Bethlehem, with the rest of the West Bank. So we always have to travel around Jerusalem because we are denied the right to go to Jerusalem. America is much closer than Jerusalem that I can see from my house. So I had to go travel around Jerusalem, take this road through the Kedron Valley. Now this road, you come to the top of the hill, you take dangerous curves, you get down the valley, you cross to the mountain front, and you cross a checkpoint, then another checkpoint, then you have to get to Jericho, then from Jericho cross to Jordan, then from Jordan take a flight to go to the U.S. We are not allowed to go to Tel Aviv too, you know. And if it happens that you fly from Jordan and come back to Tel Aviv, they will deport you. This happened to me 2 years ago. I was traveling with a friend. We arrived to Tel Aviv airport. They changed the law before I arrived, so they let my friend, who was American, to go in, and they sent me back to Amsterdam because I came with KLM. So we had to go to Jordan. Now, my cousin and I started our trip early morning to go down across that Kidron Valley area. We arrived at the top of the mountain. We saw in the valley hundreds of Palestinians being chased by one Israeli border guard patrol. They were chasing the people and pushing them back. People there were literally from 3 to 4 in the morning just waiting to cross the checkpoint. And this patrol will deny them even from getting to the checkpoint area. We said we won't travel. We should try our best. Maybe we can walk. So we got down to that area. Suddenly the patrol left. We're lucky. We got to the checkpoint, the first one, the first people at the checkpoint. But we can't cross the checkpoint with the car even. We have to change a car. So each one of us pulling his bag behind, we got to the soldiers. The soldiers said, empty your bags in the street. So we emptied our bags in the streets. Everything, all of our clothes and belongings were emptied in the middle of the street on top of the dirt and everything. Then the soldiers came and looked at our bags. They saw it empty. Then they started asking us where to go. We tell them we're traveling, and they looked at our tickets. Then they allowed us to cross, allowed us to put everything back to the bags. Then we crossed. Afterwards, we crossed another checkpoint. Then we got to Jericho. We changed the car again. And we walked through the checkpoint of Jericho. We told them that we were traveling, because the only way to go to Jordan, you have to get to Jericho. They saw our tickets again. Then we walked into Jericho. This, you have to do this under all kinds of weather circumstances. Then in Jericho, we started crossing the borders into Jordan. When we got down to the borders, this process is really long to get down the borders, because you have to pass through different kind of Israeli security. Then you get the borders. The Israeli intelligence allowed me to pass, but they did not allow my cousin. Suddenly, there were security guards with guns came at us, and they asked us to come to step behind. Then they took us aside, and they opened our bags. They took us in a different terminal. They opened our bags and literally checked everything. You can't believe how many times they checked my shoes. They checked everything we had in the bags. Then they sent us back to the terminal. And then suddenly the day was over. There were no buses to take us to the other side to Jordan. So they had to call us a VIP service, which is a van that you'll pay a lot of extra money that will get you to the other side. The van came from Jordan, picked us up. We crossed to Jordan. Now, crossing to Jordan, for any Palestinian right now living in the West Bank, you need to get like sort of a permission from the Jordanian Ministry of Interior that will allow you there. Now, we always hear that Arabs are backing up the Palestinians. We are having such a difficult time right now traveling because we have to obtain this permission. And there should be a relative from the first degree, like a cousin, first cousin, second cousin, a wife, an uncle, and an aunt, who should get you this permission from the Jordanian Ministry of Interior. We were working to get this permission for a long time. And we got it maybe 1 hour before even with the Israelis, we got it. And we were trying to get our papers ready in the Jordanians. They said, you can go, but your cousin cannot because his name is not listed. I was so surprised. And we started arguing with the Jordanians. The Jordanians said, yeah, you're traveling together? Okay, go back home together. And then we were arguing. Then suddenly the officer asked my cousin, are you a student? Then my cousin just told him, yes, I'm a student. And he did show him 4 years expired, international student card expired 4 years ago. He showed him this. He doesn't know how to read English. He looked at it. Sorry, studying, my cousin told him in Michigan. Then he said, okay, you can pass. It was that dumb, that ugly. Then we crossed to Jordan, took the flight. We arrived to Washington, D.C. And I am a special registration. That means when I arrive, I go to report to INS, they take fingerprints, take pictures, and then they ask you all questions. Why you come to the U.S., you answer all the questions. This take 2 to 3 hours. Then they did the same for my cousin. Then we're only allowed, every 30 days we have to meet INS officers. Then we're only allowed to leave at designated time from the designated airport. So this is really my story, hassled from Israelis, Palestinians, and come by the Americans. But I feel that the American people were really much more hospitable than the government at the airport. And that was really, that's really nice. And I feel really great with the hospitality here. The people are nice to me all the time, wherever I go.
So why the change of climate with, let's say, the Jordanians? Is that from U.S. pressure to do that?
It's not a change of climate. It has been always like this. It has been always like this for the Jordanians, and they give us hard time whenever they come. And myself, I always have a hard time from the Jordanians whenever I go there. And they say that because they don't want Israel to expel all the Palestinians and transfer all the Palestinians in the West Bank to Jordan. This is why they're making it difficult at the borders. But you know, when you have a ticket, you want to travel. This is my ticket. You paid $900 to get the ticket that will take you to the airport. And you know, this is a proof that you're leaving. It doesn't matter. We need to have this permission from the Ministry of Interior. It has always been that difficult. And this is from the minority who's ruling Jordan. They don't like Palestinians at all. And we always hear that, oh, they love Palestinians. They are supporting the Palestinians. All of them want to destroy Israel. But they are really helping making our life so miserable too, the same as, you know, really traveling is you think about it 10 times before you do anything, because it's that difficult.
You talked about a wall going up around Bethlehem. What is the reasoning, what is the thinking about that, and is that happening to other cities as well?
Yeah, it's really happening all over the country right now. When the wall is going to be finished, Palestinians will be living only in 12% of historic Palestine. The purpose of the wall is to protect Israeli colonizers who are living illegally in the West Bank, isolate Palestinian towns and villages, and Israel is claiming that this is, will help the security of Israelis. And for God's sake, it never helped anything. It just make things worse. What actually Ariel Sharon ran in the elections, building this wall, this will determine the borders of the future Palestinian independent state. That this state will have only borders with Israel. These borders are only controlled by Israel. Palestinians will be living in three different clusters in the West Bank. And even thinking about people who were trapped between the border, between the wall and the borders with Israel, with the green line areas, will be transferred into the wall. Right now, in the northern area of the West Bank, around Tul Karim, Qalqilia, Jenin, we're talking about 95,000 Palestinians trapped between the wall and the green line. They cannot go anywhere. We're talking about 35 underground water wells confiscated for the settlers' use. We're talking about thousands of acres have been confiscated for the wall and for the security area from each side of the wall. We're talking about farmers who cannot either reach their lands. Talking about crops dying on the trees. This is what we're really talking about. We're talking about people, major cities, who only one entrance. They can move only from one area. This is happening right now all over. They started doing the one in Hebron. They started doing the one in the Jordan Valley. They're doing the one from the western borders of the West Bank. They finished phase one. It's 8 meters high. Qalqilia is totally surrounded by it. A lot of villages are isolated. This is the only democracy in the Middle East.
Tell us more about the Holy Land Trust.
Holy Land Trust is a Palestinian non-governmental, non-profit organization established a few years ago. The establishment of Holy Land Trust came through a major trip we did in the 2000s. We were existing before that time. But the real establishment, announced the establishment, came the year 2000 in a trip that took place. We called it the Journey of the Magi. It's a real pilgrimage or a real trip, hiking, walking between borders Iraq and Iran, crossing all of Iraq, Syria, Jordan, crossing to Palestine, 99 days, trying to show the world what's really going on in all of these countries by every day reporting through the internet and media about all of these countries. Arriving to Bethlehem Christmas Day, that was Intifada already started. That was the only celebration in Bethlehem at that time. Out of this, we had real start, and we have three major departments in Holy Land Trust. The first one we have is called Remember the Innocents. You know, in the Christian tradition in Bethlehem, and it's not just in the tradition, which is one of what the history is saying, that Herod the Great killed the innocents of Bethlehem. The children of Bethlehem were killed 2,000 years ago. As a Bethlehemite, I don't feel that Herod died. I feel that Herod is still alive, where Palestinian children and children of Bethlehem are still persecuted in everyday life. And this is why we try to tell the people to remember the innocence of Palestine every day. So what we do with this department, we work with children. Every December 28th, we have a festival in Manger Square, which is a public area. Thousands of children can come and watch a drama, music, can participate in artwork and workshops. 2000, we had 5,000 children from all of Bethlehem to come and participate, which was really nice. Distributed music sang by children and all the work by children. Last year, we had 500 only because Bethlehem was under curfew, house arrest most of the time. So they allowed us that day, they allowed Bethlehemites to move around for a few hours. So we took that opportunity and we made that festival. We have a children club part of this. The children come and say, this is what we want to do. They put their plan for the whole year, and we help them having the tools to implement the plan. And this is how we prepare them to be good leaders in the future and to heal from what they have been facing all the time. We sponsor a choir in one of the schools in Bethlehem. We have right now a project called Peace Builders. The Peace Builders project is trying to systematically work with children from kindergarten up to high school about how they can communicate among themselves, with their parents, their families, and with the whole world. We're doing this in English. Doing this in English on purpose, that when they pass through all of this education, they know how to communicate with the whole world. This is the message. Talking about something very important called the Palestinian personality and how they can reveal this personality to the whole world. So this is a process happening in English. We are hoping to partner with more educators. We're working with various schools right now implementing this project. The second department, which is my work, that I try when I come to the U.S. as well to encourage people to travel. This is the right time for people to come and travel and see what's really going on and experience, have first-hand experiences about what's going on. So this department called the Travel and Encounter. People can come to Palestine and meet all kinds of people. Meet Palestinians, meet Israelis, meet left-wingers, meet Muslims, meet Christians, meet Jews. In a fact-finding delegation that you can meet everybody. In addition to this, we do faith-based trips that Christian to Christian, Muslim to Muslim, interfaith delegations, people can come and just really have the first-hand experience and learn from peace builders how they can interact and how can they help. And we try to take people all over the country, Galilee, the Golan Heights, East and West Jerusalem, all over the West Bank and Gaza. When we can, take people to Gaza, go to Hebron, and visit all of these places and get the story out and have the experience. And then people can see by themselves, and then they can know and come back here and report back and spread the word. So this is what I do. I organize these trips from A to Z. The third department in Holy Land Trust, it's called Peace and Reconciliation, which is the nonviolence work we do. We have participated through this department in helping on the organizing the International Solidarity Movement activities before. And we helped in organizing other activities in different places. Right now, we're focusing into two main things. We started doing trainings for Palestinians right after the siege of the Church of Nativity.
And when was that?
That was 1.5 years ago, June 2002. Now, wouldn't we talk about nonviolence and nonviolent activities? That doesn't mean that Palestinians never used nonviolence before. And that doesn't mean that Palestinians are the source of the violence. Occupation is the source of the violence. And what we try to do is just to educate people that and tell people that by using nonviolence, we can get more power to end the occupation. But we are not the source of the violence. But we believe that nonviolence is the most powerful tool, and we need to spare humans' lives in ending the occupation. This is how we really believe in. Now, what we started doing is like working with various groups to educate for nonviolence and put a strategy. We did a core group training in Bethlehem area. In the core group training in Bethlehem area, we developed a manual for nonviolence training in Arabic. It's the first manual. It's going to be published on our website very soon. It's in the editing process. And we used it in training in Arab American University in Jenin last July. We got the groups together from Jenin and Bethlehem, and they put a strategy how they want to work with each other. They're continuing this work while I'm here. I'm away. I participate in the training with some other people too. In addition to this, we finished a series of town meetings in different parts of the West Bank and Gaza about how we can put a strategy and work for popular resistance and civil disobedience. Out of the town meetings, committees were formed, and now everybody will pass through a training of nonviolence resistance. At the end of it, and we're hoping in March, we're going to have a national conference for nonviolence, where Palestinians come and gather in one area, get formulate a movement and push for more a wider movement and put a strategy. The most important thing that we need a strategy, and this is what we are really pushing for. Through this department, we have a media website in Arabic and English, which focus on nonviolence to show the whole world what Palestinians are doing in different parts of the country and to tell the people about the heroes of steadfastness. This website, people can go to it in www.palestinenet.org, or they can go to Holy Land Trust website, www.holylandtrust.org, and you can find the link to it.
It seems that part of your strategy then in bringing the media in is people coming back and reporting what they've seen. Mm-hmm. Do you have other strategies as well to crack open that media blockade?
We try our best to work with media people down there and back in Palestine and get them involved. It's not very easy. Once we were organizing nonviolent direct actions during the Israeli elections, and so this guy, we call him, and he says, well, we are only covering two things, either the Israeli elections or the Palestinian violence. That's it. So we try to work hard with them. And as well, we are trying to get more of the internet and make the news on the internet available for everybody. So this is one thing we try to do. And our website, we have a few thousand hits a day, but I don't think it's still enough. We need more people to know. And I think this is really a big task. And that's what we're trying to reach out here to the people and the groups and tell people what's really going on. And when people come and visit and report back, we need always new people to come and see by themselves. And we need to have influential people who can come and see by themselves. We need to have leaders to come and see, not just because it's something good for them, because it's a responsibility for each leader in a community or in a church, in a mosque, in a synagogue, to come and see what's going on. It's a responsibility for every human being to see how other human beings are living. I don't say this because we are living under occupation and we are suffering from the occupation on a daily basis, because that does really affect everybody. And people have a responsibility to see and know and understand and help. And I say this because I want people to know that everybody that hears this message, after he gets or she gets this message, they are responsible in doing something. And I totally believe it's a responsibility. It's my responsibility to see and understand the suffering of other people in different countries.
Do you think American citizens bear more responsibility for coming and seeing what's going on there because of the significant amount of money that American taxpayers contribute to the Israeli army?
I think the only government that can really make the real change over there is the government of the U.S. So the U.S. citizens are really, really should know what their government foreign policy and how their government foreign policy is affecting their lives here. For example, America used veto against the Palestinians 36 times. Recently, 1 month ago, used veto against a decision by the Security Council for stopping building and dismantling the wall, the apartheid wall that Israel is building right now. There was a veto from the U.S. That's something we can't understand. When Americans come and see, we need them to tell their governments and their leaders what to do. Because it's not just a responsibility from the Americans towards me or my people, it's towards themselves and their people and their money and what their money is doing. So I think the people who can really make the change the most are the Americans. So it's a responsibility for the Americans to come and see and understand, meet Palestinians, meet Israelis, and participate in actions for justice and peace.
And take the nonviolence training that that your organization helps bring
and,
to people.
And other organizations too.
And again, locally, what? How would people here in the Seattle area plug into that?
This is my second trip to Seattle, and well received from various groups. And I am sending this call through this your radio station, and I am sending this call for people to connect with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and the Palestine Solidarity Committee, and get involved and do something, trying to understand. And here I'm not asking people to be enemies to Israel, by the way. I'm asking people, if they are friends of Israel, they continue being friends of Israel, but to be good friends to Israel. Being good friends, that means you have to tell me what's right, what's wrong, what's human, what's inhuman. And we're asking people to do so. We are not here to create enemies. We're here to create justice. So I think in the Seattle area, people need to know there are people who try their best every day. They're dedicated their lives here, people in the Seattle area, to do something. And those people need help, 100%. And they need their voice to be heard. They have experienced all of these kind of suffering along with the Palestinians. A lot of them came from Seattle and came to Palestine, and they really experienced what the situation that means. Connect with them, see where they are, hear their stories, and try to come over and understand. If you can't come, you can teach others.
I think for a lot of people who are already knowledgeable about the situation in Palestine, Israel, coming over and participating in your fact-finding trips would be viable. What about a lot of the other people that have been polarized by this issue? How do we get a discussion, a dialogue going on an issue that probably is one of the most, I'll use polarizing again, most polarizing issues of our times, if not in history?
Well, you know, there are principles for any discussions. Even people who are very much pro-Israeli, as I said earlier, it's their responsibility to hear what Palestinians have to say. In this country, mass media makes people hear the Israeli point of view all the time, and you rarely hear the Palestinian point of view. So it's a responsibility for me to hear what the Israelis have to say. And for the pro-Israeli, they really need to hear what the Palestinians have to say. Okay? I'm not talking about just a dialogue. A dialogue without an action, that really doesn't make any difference. I think a dialogue where people know the facts and know what's going on, and they have to know and have an idea about international law, human rights, United Nations resolutions, implementations of United Nations resolutions, and Geneva Convention, and how this is really implemented by the State of Israel back in Palestine. And now, if these are the principles, I think, for any dialogue, the principles that based on the facts, even people who are pro-Israel, they can come and see, and then they can start a dialogue. A dialogue that's not based on justice and equality cannot be a dialogue. It should be based on justice and equality, and people should be able to listen to each other. And I am sending this call for everybody, that if you want to hear, if you want to talk about the issue between Palestine and Israel, people need to have an open heart, an open mind, and acceptance of what the other side should say. And this is important. When people come over and see and experience what does occupation means, what does systematic suffering and humiliation, people will be able to do something. They still can support whoever they want to support. But there is humanity is being killed and slaughtered every day. What's in common between me and everybody in Seattle, that we are all humans, so we all stand for humanity. We don't stand for anybody. We stand for humanity. That's number one. If we are friends with other people, that's fine. Continuing being friend of Israel, that's fine. But people need to stand for humanity that's being killed every day. There's nobody more equal than anybody else. It's really important. This is the basic principles for any dialogue. I have done dialogues with Israelis for 12 years.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I've been talking with George Rishmawi, who is with the Holy Land Trust and the International Solidarity Movement. Thanks for spending
time
with us today,
much.
George.